This week, the woman Freemason. No, not can women be Freemasons. The actual woman Freemason. This week, Worshipful Brother Patrick Day takes us through the truth about the woman Freemason, how she became initiated in a time before Grand Lodge, before landmarks and all the rest. And then we'll take some time and explore those landmarks. Where did they come from? And do each of the individual landmarks have any basis anywhere? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 627. Right away, want to go ahead and throw a shout out to our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners. You guys are the ones who make this show possible. And without you, we can't do it the way we do it, which is by putting all of these things that most people don't even realize are part of the production. That is, ensuring that we are uploading the audio at dual channel stereo at 320 kbps, which is higher than CD quality. All of these kinds of things, just little nuanced pieces that a lot of people don't realize that we do. Getting access to publications and being able to read things that no one else can read. We're going out of our way to get permissions and doing all of those kinds of things in order to bring you the best possible Masonic education that is out there. Of course, we've been doing this since July of 2011 and getting better every single year thanks to your help. So if you're curious on how you can help support the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on support the show, check out the various options. And again, we've got a ton of other ways to support the program. Just explore the website. And if you don't feel like doing any of that, then perhaps just consider giving us a share, a like, or telling your friends and brothers about the show. In the news, we made some updates to our presentation schedule. There is a event happening on March 9th, 2024. It's the Kankakee Fantasy Con, which is going to be pretty sweet. Brother Darren Laners and myself will be there, not representing WCY or Meet Act Part, but our joint venture Beyond the Fourth Veil. So if you enjoy all things about strangeness, high strangeness, UFOs, aliens, cryptids, all that kind of stuff, we're going to be there doing that. I think we'll be doing perhaps a panel discussion at some point during that day as well. Not Masonic, but fun nonetheless. March 16th, I'll be in the Chicagoland area doing a joint presentation for chapter and council. Topic is TBD at this point. April 2nd, I'll be doing Esoterics 101 at Middleton Ionic 180 in Middleton, Wisconsin. April 6th. I'll be up in London, Ontario. That's right, in Canada. I'll be guest lecturing up there. That's going to be kind of an all-day event, and I really can't wait to spend some time with brothers from the north. April 13th, I'll be doing The Lost Word, the Tetragrammaton, out at Richmond Randolph Lodge 19 in Richmond, Virginia. April's really busy. We've got I'll be doing a virtual presentation on the 29th. For Ontario Masons, May 3rd through the 5th, I want to let you guys know about this because I'm not presenting or anything. I'm just going to be there selling merch for Skull and Crown Limited, raising money for the WCY podcast, and that's going to be out at the Midwest Conference of Masonic Education. This is huge. This is for anyone who is interested in Masonic education, involved in Masonic education on any level, and we really are stressing the idea that Masonic educators need to come together and celebrate what they do, learn from one another, and that's what happens at the Midwest Conference. Now, it's called the Midwest Conference because, well, it was in the Midwest, and it still is, but it's the only one that survived. There were conferences all over the United States for regions, and the Midwest Conference is the only one that's still going strong, and it probably will end up being the national conference on Masonic education at some point, if I had to bet on it. Now, this year it's going to be in Bloomington, Minnesota, at the Minnesota Masonic Heritage Center, and it's a three-day deal, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Now, the 5th, there's typically not a whole lot to wrap up, but we do get to eat breakfast together, finish up any remaining business we have to do, But it is a great time. And again, we have so many brothers out there involved in education who think, oh, we can't break out and we can't get into the Conference of Grand Masters or this, that, and the other. Well, guess what, guys? That's because that's a conference for Grand Masters. And for the longest time, they've put education at the kids' table. Well, we've got a conference that's arguably bigger than the Grand Masters conference and offers much more education. And we can take that and we can start grassroots movements. We've seen the tugboat turn in a bathtub in the last few years in terms of education. And post-COVID, I have to say I have witnessed a decline in Grand Lodge's emphasis on Masonic education. And it makes me wonder what we can attribute that to. Is it Grand Lodge's seeing that, oh, these guys do their thing online, we don't have to promote them anymore? Is it them doubling down on just membership and trying to get more members rather than fulfill our obligations as Masons to the new members by providing what we said we would provide? I don't know. But all that'll be discussed likely at the Midwest Conference of Masonic Education. So I hope to see you guys there. Out of all of these events, I think that one's the most important, definitely through May. That's the one to go to if you got to pick something. Well, first up this week, as you heard in the top of the program, we've got a great piece, another Masonic Mythbusters from Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. Now, Worshipful Brother Day is a listener and sponge of pulling anything Masonic education in, and he is a very smart dude. Well, recently, he had been listening to his favorite Masonic podcasts, as he does. And of course, on that list is the Old Fashioned Masonic Podcast. A great podcast, great hosts, great dudes. But he recently listened to an episode that had to do with the woman Freemason, that famous woman Freemason who was initiated. And he took some issue with it in that the education that was read on the podcast and then discussed had erroneous information, which led to a discussion that was not the best it could be. And so, not that he had anything poorly to say about the podcast, but rather the education that he read. And so this week, he's going to talk to us about the factual information regarding the woman Freemason. And he'll point out a few parts of that article that was read previously on the Old Fashioned Masonic Podcast. And were they straight? And I have some interesting insights as well on this that I'd like to pull the thread on a little later on in the show. So, without any further ado, let's get into this great new episode of Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Was a woman ever lawfully made a Mason? Now, recently on the Old Fashioned Masonic Podcast, the brothers involved talked about the Honorable Elizabeth Howard Nee St. Ledger Altworth, who is famously known as the Lady Freemason. She is considered to be, by many, to be the only woman to lawfully be made a Mason. I mean, other women have been made Masons since her initiation, but those women have always been subject to disputes of legitimacy or being clandestine, but not Elizabeth Altworth. Of all the Masons listed in Ravi Denslow's 10,000 Famous Freemasons, the only woman he lists is Elizabeth Altworth. And that means something because Denslow, you know, he does not include people like Oscar Wilde, who would be expelled, and he does not include Prince Hall Masons because, well, they were still deemed clandestine by the Grand Lodge of Missouri, his grand jurisdiction, when he published that book. And he does not include John Steinbeck, who demitted with a very spiteful opinion of Freemasonry, and many other such examples. The fact that Denslow includes Elizabeth Altworth must mean that he must have deemed her initiation to be legitimate. Now, I personally find her initiation into masonry, and really herself, to be just utterly fascinating. Thus, I need to dispute what was talked about on the old-fashioned Masonic podcast. Now, let me be clear. I like this podcast. I listen to it whenever they release a new episode, and I find the brothers on that podcast to be humorous, and I kind of like listening to them chat. But they found a really bad piece of Masonic education that was just full of inaccuracies and misrepresentations, and then they would speculate upon this bad information. And this is just a recipe for the further perpetuation of more bad information. So I'm not necessarily criticizing the old-fashioned Masonic podcast, but rather their source. And really, the only criticism I have for the old-fashioned Masonic podcast concerning that episode is that they read this article and they did no further research, which is just disappointing. I mean, she has a Wikipedia page. No one bothered doing a Google search for her. I don't know. It's disappointing, but that's really my only criticism. What I really take issue with is the article they were talking about. Now, they get their information for this episode from a website, mastermason.com, on which is a short piece written by William R. Fisher. This is supposed to be a 5-minute short talk written specifically for this website for really any Master Mason to use for lodge education. Now, note, this is not a short talk bulletin, i.e. those distributed by the Masonic Service Association. And this entire short talk is just loaded with inaccuracies. And this is not the only article out there that is loaded with inaccuracies about the Lady Freemason. So let's set the record straight of who she was and how she became a Freemason. This short talk article states that Elizabeth was initiated in 1735. Nope. In fact, I can't really find any other sources that claim any other date than sometime in the 1710s. We're not totally sure what year she was initiated because those old records are lost. Most of what we know about her comes from testimonies from brothers such as Arundel Hill, as well as his sons. Arundel Hill was at her initiation, and his sons would sit and lodge with her after her initiation. Kathleen Aldworth Foster, who is a descendant of the Aldworth family, though she's not a direct descendant of Elizabeth Aldworth, she proposes that Arundel Hill was one of her suitors. Most sources place her initiation between 1710 and 1712, usually 1712. And she is attested to have been 17 years old when she was initiated. Such would mean that she was born in 1695, but some sources place her initiation in 1710, which would place her date of birth in 1693. Her birthday has more or less always been established based on her age when she was initiated. I believe we're more certain now that she was born in 1695, so it is more universally agreed that she was initiated in 1712. We know she was initiated before she was married to her husband, Richard Aldworth, in 1713. The Honorable Richard Aldworth was also a Mason and is believed to have been present at Elizabeth's initiation. I think the date of circa 1735 appears to come from a misunderstanding of an article on Elizabeth by Edward Conder, who published an essay on Elizabeth as the Lady Freemason in Ars Coronatorum, Volume 8, 1896. Conder states that in a footnote, quote, "we are gravely informed," end quote, that she was born in 1713 and initiated in 1734. However, Elizabeth's marriage bond is dated 1713, so it would be a little weird to be married the year you were born. That seems illegal. And I suppose 1734 is just because that would make Elizabeth 21 years old, the customary time of becoming a Freemason. This appears to be a blunder by whatever source Conder found these erroneous dates from. Note he says gravely informed, indicating that the information is bad. Conder was familiar with the 1811 memoir about Elizabeth Aldworth, published 36 years after her death. Conder appears to get most of his information from this pamphlet and concurs with the 1710 initiation date and the 1693 birth date. Potentially, the 1735 date comes from the year that Dunerail Lodge No. 44 would receive its charter from the Grand Lodge of Ireland. Dunerail Lodge had existed for at least a year or so before Elizabeth's initiation. I think the confusion is that someone cannot imagine anyone being initiated into a lodge without a charter, but mind you that lodges existed before Grand Lodges existed because, well, lodges would form Grand Lodges. Dunerail Lodge certainly existed prior to any Grand Lodges ever existing, much less the Grand Lodge of Ireland, which was formed in 1725. However, Dunerail Lodge would not request or receive their official charter until 1735. Presumably, they would be one of those existing lodges that continue to be imposed to the entire concept of Grand Lodges. Now, prior to the formation of any Grand Lodge anywhere, lodges were basically their own sovereign jurisdictions. They had mutual relations with other lodges, certainly, but they governed themselves. There was no, like, constitutions or anything. It would be presumed that in 1712, Masonry was still regarded as just like a gentleman's society, but nowhere was it really explicitly stated that no women were allowed. Looking at one of the oldest Masonic catechisms, the Edinburgh Register House manuscript of 1696, in which there's just no mention of women or prohibition of women. I also don't see any explicit prohibitions on women in Samuel Pritchard's Masonry Dissected 1730. So Dunerail Lodge likely had the sovereign authority to decide for themselves if they would permit a woman to be initiated. Now back to the Short Talk article, which would state that Elizabeth was the sister of Lord Arthur St. Leger, first Viscount of Dunerail. Nope. She was his daughter, his youngest child and only surviving daughter. He had three sons. Kathleen Oldworth Foster suggests that there was another daughter, but she died in childhood. I will revisit Foster's information later. Anyway, here we are, two sentences into the Short Talk, and we already have two or three just absolutely blatant errors. So we're off to a great start. Next, the Short Talk states that Elizabeth was deliberately hiding in the storage room adjacent to the lodge room, which was in Dunerail Court, her home. Also no. I also heard that she was in a closet, she was in the rafters. Nope, there's no rafters in that room. No, she was in the library. Now, archaeological efforts have been made to understand the changes to the house over the decades, from testimonies to records of the Dunerail estate. It has been assessed that the western portion of the ground floor was a large hall, likely originally a library and drawing room. However, by 1710, the hall began to be used for lodge meetings, and thus the construction of a wall dividing the room into the lodge room and the library was undertaken. The 1811 memoir states that there was an archway being built into this wall to connect the lodge room to the library. So the wall may have already been existing, and an opening between them was being made. Whatever the case, the wall had construction being done on it, which meant there were loose bricks that would allow a curious little girl to peer into the lodge room. The night that Elizabeth was initiated, she had fallen asleep in the library while reading. Then night fell, and Mason showed up for a meeting. There, she was able to remove a loose brick and view a portion of the Masonic proceedings through the wall that was still under construction. This Short Talk article states that the lodge was conferring a fellowcraft degree, but no historical information supports that. We only know that a degree was being conferred and that Elizabeth grew uncomfortable when the oath was being taken. presumably the penalties of violating a Masonic obligation, and that just made her feel uncomfortable, and thus she tried to sneak out of the library. Now, according to the 1811 memoir, the only way out of the library was through the lodge room, so while the Masons were holding their meeting, she tried to sneak through the lodge room to get out when she was caught. However, research into the changes to the house showed that the library had a separate door that led out into the foyer, a separate door from the lodge room. It was known that the wall between the library and the lodge room was a security risk for secret meetings. So when she snuck out of the library, she would have been caught by the Tyler, who would have understood that she may have seen something through the wall under construction. Now, following the 1811 memoir, just as she was about to escape the lodge room, she began to pull the door open when she was caught by the Tyler, who also was the butler of Dunderale Court, William Simon, who's holding this big Tyler sword. This frightened her and she screamed, which alerted everyone in the lodge of an intruder. Now, Edward Conder would have a different opinion, believing that the Tyler caught her as she was leaving the library through its own separate door. The brethren would then take her back to the library. They'd interrogate her on why was she there and what had she seen. Then she was left there with another brother or two while the rest of the men returned to the lodge to deliberate on what to do, in which they decided, if she agreed, to initiate her. An extract from the 1811 memoir, the following was written, quote, "It must be fully understood that although she was perfectly aware that her father's lodge was held at the house, she had no idea on entering the library that on that evening a meeting was about to be held in the adjoining room," end quote. It does not appear by any testimonies or accounts that her spying on a Masonic meeting was premeditated or malicious. She was simply a young woman who fell asleep in the library while reading. Then she awoke when she heard unusual things in the adjacent room, and since she could easily remove a brick from the wall under construction, she did so and just started watching. Now, I have read and heard variations of this tale in which it has been asserted that she did it deliberately, that she was trying to use it as blackmail in order to make them make her a Mason, etc. The fact that no Masons who knew her or were at her initiation speak of anything nefarious about her, and that she has always been held in high regard by Irish Masons since her time, is really indicative that she had no malintent. In fact, the assertions that she had ill intentions spring up decades after her death. Furthermore, when the Grand Lodge of Ireland was formed, no one ever protested her membership or disputed the validity of her lawful initiation. And that says something, too. Further, it does not appear that any of the Masons there considered death for her intrusion. From that same 1811 memoir, the following is given. Quote, "Having acquainted Miss St. Leger with the great responsibility she had unwittingly taken upon herself, pointed out that only one course was open to them. The fair culprit, with a high sense of honor, at once consented to pass through the impressive ceremonials she had already in part witnessed." End quote. Only one course was open to them, which was initiation. Apparently, death was not even considered. And let's be real, it's kind of preposterous to consider that Masons would actually kill her, or really any intruder, much less the daughter of the Lord of the Court where they met. That would draw unnecessary attention, and it would not relieve them of charges of murder. I guess, I mean, if they were being particularly officious, you know, following Masonic law, the penalties of a violation of Masonic oaths technically only pertains to the person who has taken the oath and not necessarily upon, say, an intruder. I don't know. It's just ridiculous to presume that they were actually going to kill her. They could have easily just said, "Oh, young lady, your feeble brain cannot comprehend these things. Just go to bed and forget about all this, silly little lass. It was all a bad dream. Here's some laudanum to calm your nerves. Good night, and don't come in here again. I mean, in all honesty, that sounds like the kind of misogyny you'd expect for the 18th century. But apparently they thought she was intelligent enough and worthy enough to be made a mason. I don't know, I find that within the historical context of the time, it's remarkable that they made her a mason instead of just dismissing her as a feeble-minded little girl. Now, one thing that Short Talk article gets right is that she only ever became a Fellowcraft. That's true. That's as far as we know she ever progressed. However, that was also not uncommon at the time. That was highly usual. And the other thing that it got right was that she was ever remembered as a benevolent member of her lodge, always willing to assist any distressed brother from her own purse. Yeah, that's pretty well attested as well. Now, if you're interested in reading more about the Lady Freemason, I recommend a short pamphlet printed in 1914 by John Day, entitled Memoir of the Honorable Elizabeth Aldworth, the Lady Freemason, which was recently reproduced by the Provincial Grand Lodge of Munster in 2019, and recently reprinted in issue number 28 of the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. Edward Condor published his article about Elizabeth Aldworth and her Masonic career in volume 8 of Ars Corticorinatorum in 1896. And W.J. Chetwood Crawley's, he has some great notes to this paper in that same volume. In 2022, Kathleen Aldworth Foster published a historical novel on Elizabeth Aldworth and her initiation into Freemasonry, entitled Doneraile Court, The Story of the Lady Freemason. I actually really enjoyed reading this novel. If I were to call it anything, I don't like to describe things with this word usually, but it was cute. Like, it really was. It was enjoyable, and I found it to be really cute. It's like, of all the historical people you could write a historical novel on, and it turned out to be cute and it would work, it's definitely Elizabeth Aldworth. Anyway, fantastic book. You have to take the exact details of the novel with a grain of salt. But in examining the bibliography that the author provides, she had really good access to records of Doneraile Court, the records of the St. Ledgers, as well as the Aldworths. Such, personally, it should merit further investigation for historical purposes. It's kind of disappointing that it ended up in a novel. I wish I could have gotten exact citations and sources, but anyway. While the novel is intriguing in the historical information it utilizes, you should bear in mind it's a novel, not a historical monograph. So that is how Elizabeth Aldworth became the Lady Freemason. It is a tale of intrigue and curiosity. It isn't a tale that needs to be romanticized or misconstrued or modified. It is interesting on its own merit. I'm sorry bad information floats around out there about her, but better material is readily available if you wish to dig further into her fascinating Masonic life.
All right, what an amazing piece. Tons of great information, and information that kind of makes much more sense if we think about it. Construction, a library, just very interesting. Now, one thing that Patrick said in the piece, and this is what I was alluding to before we started the segment, was there was something I wanted to pull the thread on a little bit. And that is that because this lodge that initiated a woman was pre-Grand Lodge, this was also pre-Masonic landmarks, if you will. So the Masonic landmarks are indeed a list of things that make Masonry Masonry. It's kind of interesting. And there are different versions of these landmarks, and different ones are accepted in different states. Some actually have no basis anywhere. And who came up with these? Well, largely the first person to sort of organize them is really Mackey. And that's not so old, is it? And so let's not confuse the ancient charges with Masonic landmarks. These are two different things. but hardly either of them are ancient. Now, the Masonic landmarks in and of themselves are pretty interesting, and I'll read you a little bit about them and perhaps have some commentary on some of them, but what I'm really curious about here is that these Masonic landmarks, having not existed, did not prohibit this lodge from initiating a woman. In fact, there was no such rule. So where do those rules come from? Well, let's take a look at the Masonic landmarks. For instance, Masonic landmarks are a set of principles that Freemasons claim to be ancient and unchangeable. They issue regularity of Masonic lodges, Grand Lodges, Grand Orients, and they're really judged in context of the landmarks. And because each Grand Lodge is self-governing, with no single body exercising authority over the whole of Freemasonry, the interpretations of these principles can and do vary, leading to controversies of recognition. So different Masonic jurisdictions have different landmarks. Now, their origins, according to Percy Jantz, who's the Masonic term landmark, has biblical origins. He cites the book of Proverbs 22:28. "Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set," referring to stone pillars set to mark boundaries of land. He further quotes a Jewish law, "Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark which that they of old time have set in thine inheritance," to emphasize how these landmarks designate inheritance. Now, Albert Mackey expands on the above historical significance of landmarks by saying, quote, "The universal language and the universal laws of Masonry are landmarks, but not so are the local ceremonies, laws, and usages, which vary in different countries. To attempt to alter or remove these sacred landmarks is one of the most heinous offenses that a Mason can commit." And then Mark Tabbert says that he believes that the actual rules and regulations laid down in early Masonic landmarks derive from charges of medieval stonemasons. So here we've got kind of three sources of where perhaps these landmarks come from. And the rules that these landmarks are citing, like where do they come from? So far we've just cited, the landmarks come from this. But if we go to those origins, where do we see anywhere listed any of these rules that exist within landmarks? This is the origin of a landmark, but not the origin of the landmarks. Very weird, if we're thinking about it in this way, especially when we want concrete proof of where these rules come from. Who set them? Well, let's get into a little bit of the history. Now, according to the general regulations published by the Premier Grand Lodge of England in 1723, quote, "Every annual Grand Lodge has an inherent power and authority to make new regulations or to alter these for the real benefits of this ancient fraternity, provided always that the old landmarks be carefully preserved." Huh, what are those old landmarks? So these landmarks were not defined in any manner. In 1844, George Oliver writes that some jurisdictions restrict the definition of a Masonic landmark to be only the signs, tokens, and words, while others include ceremonies of initiation, passing, raising of a candidate. Some also include the ornaments, furniture, jewels of a lodge, or their characteristic symbols. Now, in 1863, Oliver published the Freemasonry's Treasury, in which he listed 40 different landmarks, and then Mackey expounded on both of these lists and remarked that the safest method of defining the landmarks is, quote, "those ancient and therefore universal customs of the order which either gradually grew into operation as rules of action or, if at once enacted by any competent authority, were enacted at a period so remote that no account of their origin is to be found in the records of history," end quote. Now, this is somewhat, interesting just on the fact that you've left a real opening here for there to never be any record of anything except hearsay, which is awfully damn convenient, if I do say so. Really, what Mackey seems to be saying here is that, sure, there are rules that we must abide by because they have been the rule. Yeesh. So much for a progressive society. Or sometimes we have to add to the rules by the authority given to the Grand Master. Okay, that's innovation, something we're not supposed to do. And then, of course, there is that we have to abide by rules that were enacted in a period so remote that no account of their origin is to be found. Real convenient. But let's get into these 25 landmarks. So there are 25 from Mackey. Okay, so the first is fraternal modes of recognition, and I'll just go through the list. Okay, so yeah, fraternal modes of recognition. The division of Masonry into three symbolic degrees. The symbolic legend of Hiram Abiff, the government of the fraternity by the Grand Master, a prerogative of the Grand Master to preside over every assembly of the craft, the prerogative of the Grand Master to issue dispensations for conferring degrees at irregular times, the prerogative of the Grand Master to issue dispensations for opening or holding lodge otherwise not established, the prerogative of the Grand Master to make Masons at sight, the necessity for Masons to congregate in lodges, the government of lodges to be by a master and two wardens, the necessity that every lodge, when congregated, be duly tiled, the right of every Mason to be represented in all general meetings of the craft, the right of every Mason to appeal from his lodge decisions to the Grand Master, the right of every Mason to sit in every regular lodge, that no unknown visitor be allowed to sit in lodge without being examined and found to be a Freemason, that no lodge can interfere in the business of another lodge, that every Freemason be amenable to the laws and regulations of the jurisdiction in which he resides, that candidates for Freemasonry be required to meet certain qualifications, namely, being a man of mature age, not a cripple, and freeborn, that a belief in the existence of God be a requirement for membership, that belief in a resurrection to a future life be a requirement for membership, that a book of the law shall constitute an indispensable part of the furniture of every lodge, the equality of Masons, the secrecy of the institution, the foundation of a speculative science upon an operative art, and the symbolic use and explanation of the terms of that art for purposes of moral teaching, that none of these landmarks can be changed. Yeesh. So if you agree to these, then that last one kind of locks them all in stone. But which of these 25 landmarks falls under what category of the landmarks? Meaning, are these so ancient? Does a particular landmark represent one that has been in existence since time immemorial that we have no evidence for, so we just accept it? Which one is a practice we've been doing so long that we just take it? Which one is a practice that was an innovation put forth by a particular Grand Master at some point or a group of Grand Masters? We don't know where these come from. There's no actual citation or anything that Mackey gives us to know where these rules even come from, other than kind of just a objective how Masons do it globally at the time he wrote this, and to what he was privy to knowing of those jurisdictions and lodges. So if we go on, Roscoe Pound puts his together, and he lists just seven of them. And he says, belief in a supreme being, belief in immortality, that a book of sacred law is an indispensable part of the furniture or furnishings of the lodge, the legend of the third degree, secrecy, symbolism of operative masonry, and that a mason must be a man freeborn and of lawful age. If we were to accept, A, that masonry is based on an operative guild, then it is interesting to note that a mason would have put his hand on the guild bylaws to take an obligation, not necessarily a book of sacred law, probably just a book of bylaws. Belief in a supreme being, and the immortality, those are interesting in and of themselves. I think the belief in a supreme being is much more progressive than what Mackey puts forward, as well as the belief in immortality being way more progressive than a belief in the fact that you come back in some sort of future life, like as a resurrection, just due to the connotation of resurrection and Abrahamic faiths. Now, then you have the modern interpretations, and so this, what I'm about to read to you, has zero authority to govern these at all. But in the last century, several American Grand Lodges attempted to enumerate the landmarks, ranging from West Virginia and New Jersey to Nevada and Kentucky, and in the 1950s, the Commission on Information for Recognition of the Conference of Grand Masters of Masons in North America upheld just three ancient landmarks. and that is monotheism, an unalterable and continuing belief in God. That's interesting that it's monotheism. It's sort of a regression from a belief in a supreme being to a singular God. Number two is the volume of sacred law, an essential part of the furniture of the lodge. And number three, prohibition of the discussion of religion and politics within the lodge. No mention of women or anything else. So, where do we get these things? And moreover, I want to focus on Mackey's 25 landmarks, number 18, that the candidates of Masonry be required to meet certain qualifications, namely being a man of mature age, not a cripple and reborn. Where does this come from? And so if we are to take that stance and compare it to something that was done earlier by this lodge in making a woman a Mason, did they break this landmark? Well, according to this lodge who did this before Mackey wrote these, then I guess they didn't break any rules. But then again, Mackey says that these are ancient in origin, so it had to have existed prior to the time of initiating this woman. But if that's true, where is that given? And I'm sorry, but in today's world, we have to have evidence. We can't just say it once enacted by any competent authority or were enacted at a period so remote that no account of their origin is to be found in the records of history. That doesn't work. That's erroneous. You can't just say that. There has to be evidence. And if there isn't, then you have to say that. Not that it's wrong, but you have to admit this, that there is no evidence for this, and that he came up with this language based on the practices of the organization at the time he wrote this, and that it was the flavor of the day. So if we look at some of these items, for instance, Tabard cites stonemasonry. Well, stonemasonry or stonecraft, this is the creation of buildings, structures, and sculptures using stones as the primary material. There are many different disciplines. When we're talking about actual classical stonemasonry, things like rubble masonry, dry stone, cyclopean masonry, ashlar masonry, we're talking about the buildings of ancient structures and churches and temples and just anything you could think of. So we have to say, in those systems, what were the candidates for stonemasonry's qualifications? Did it say you had to be a man of mature age, not a cripple and freeborn? Well, women were admitted to membership in the majority of medieval craft guilds, even stonemasonry. Feel free to look up Sabina von Steinbeck. Now, so I'm not sure that anything exists within the rules of a stonemason that say a woman can't be a mason. I'm not sure that stands up. But what about Proverbs, the book of Proverbs, you know, this biblical text? Well, aside from the Duke of Sussex removing all religious dogma prior to Mackey's landmarks, it doesn't do well to quote something like Proverbs. However, if we do want to look at that, really, there are several portions of Proverbs that deal with women. Namely, the fact that it says things like, attributes wisdom and virtue to women. It says the worthy wife, you know, this is the book that contains well-known passages known as the Proverbs 31 women that describes the characteristics of an ideal wife or woman of noble character. It talks about them in terms of speech and conduct, of beauty and modesty and domestic and family life. Some specific examples, if you're looking for those, we can say that Proverbs 11:16, a gracious woman retains honor, but ruthless men retain riches. 12:4, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who brings shame is like rottenness in the bones. 14:1, the wise woman builds her house, but with her own hands the foolish one tears her down. 18:22, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. So these are just a few of the selected verses from the books of Proverbs, but there's nothing here that says anything specific about women can't do X, Y, Z. So that too seems to be a poor place to look for any sort of reconciling of why these even exist. It seems as though we wanted to plant the seed and then say they've been there forever, whether you want to believe it or not. And then by agreeing to the 25th landmark, you agree that they can't be changed and thus locked into forever, potentially neutering the idea of a progressive moral science for all time. Now that's just a few of these examples, and I hope what I've done here is allowed you to sort of think in a roundabout way of where these rules come from. Always question everything. You will find that many of the landmarks do have basis and authority, at least perhaps in terms of where they started, maybe Anderson's constitutions or something. But the real point here is to not just accept at face value some sort of catch-all, like time immemorial, or no origin of this can be found and we just deal with that. No, I don't think that works. It is incumbent upon you as a Mason to ask the pertinent questions and to know where these things come from and not to just take what you're given. Because after all, any sort of landmarks or rules that exist because that you as a Mason make up part of your lodge, and that lodge had an original authority unto itself. But since the agreement of a Grand Lodge system, now lodges give the Grand Lodge authority. And they tell the Grand Lodge, in a collective way, which laws and rules are to govern the craft. So you see, you as the Mason are the one who assists in making these rules. And if you don't like one of them, because you understand it way better than it is proposed to be on paper, it's your duty to inform your less informed brethren and to move forward with either solidifying something that's existing or questioning and possibly amending something that makes no sense, even if it means its removal. And with that, I wish you all a good week. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners for the WCY podcast. If you're interested on how you can support the podcast, head on over to the website and check out your various options there. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week with a brand new Masonic Mythbusters and some additional educational content to keep you engaged in Masonry and a well-informed brother. Take care. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
Hey, Z-A-S-G-A.